The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
And now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff.
I think, in a way, putting personal politics, personal feelings aside, I think, like, to a lot of people, the election of Trump is like this absolutely unbelievable thing. Like, it's something, it's an event that was so unbelievable that they have to fill the narrative with, like, conspiracy theory. Whether the conspiracy theory is real or not, is your mileage may vary, you know. I'm kind of waiting to see how it all shakes out, you know what I mean? But it's like, to me, it's I'm waiting to see how it all shakes out. I'm leaning towards the Russian conspiracy that Trump was, like, working with the Russians somehow. And it's like, part of the reason why I'm leaning towards it is he's not making it very easy for me to believe him, because he seems to be bungling things left and right to try and cover something up. It's like, clearly, or he's just, like, really terrible at being president. Because he's like, something weird is going on, man. I think we can all agree that, like, we're seeing some kind of, like, covert war play out right in front of our eyes. Like, some kind of covert intelligence versus executive branch war playing out. You know? Clearly, as these leaks keep coming every day, more and more damning leaks, to, like, bury this guy under a tsunami of scandalous stuff. You know? And I can only look at what they're telling me, you know what I'm saying? So this will all shake out eventually, I hope, you know, but it certainly looks to me like, and I'm no Donald Trump fan, but it certainly looks to me like they're doing their best to push him out of office, like, as soon as fucking possible.
I do think that appears to be the case. I think that there is an ongoing investigation hoping to find anything that they can use if not defame him, then actually go so far as to present grounds for impeachment. I do think that people feel that, and maybe they're right to feel that way. Maybe they feel that, you know, based on his low popularity, based on his performance in office the first 100 days and the strange ups and downs that we see, maybe people are scared enough that they say, we've got to do no matter what. And at all costs, we've got to do everything we can to find legal grounds to get him out of there. That guy, you know, cannot serve as our commander-in-chief. On the other hand, I mean, there are a lot of ways that we can look at this. I mean, I wonder, again, Trump trying to hide or cover something up versus Trump continuing to just do exactly what I was talking about, doing a poor job. This whole firing of Comey thing, my gut kind of tells me that rather than trying to hide something by firing Comey, that more than anything, it's just that's the way Trump behaves, and expect the unexpected in the most literal sense with him. Whether, you know, it's confirming a controlled limited air strike against Syria, whether it be, you know, firing the FBI director,
right,
going to the Middle East, you know, making surprise visits here and there, you know, giving information to Russia, you know, purportedly, you know, via Israel, which may be classified information. I mean, whatever the case may be, you know, there's going to be what Trump does and the way that people interpret it. But no matter what, you will be able to, without question, expect the unexpected with him and his presidency. That's what we're seeing right now. So I think that that's part of what leads to a lot of questions. A lot of people say this is all controlled behavior. He knows exactly what he's doing and we can't trust him. Alternatively, some people might say we know exactly what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing and he should be trusted. Then there are others who would say this guy's a nutcase and that's all the more reason not to trust him. I mean, wherever you stand, yeah, like you say, Banal, this is a very strange period, and politically this is unprecedented in the history of America. But I can't help but ask how has media contributed to that? You know, I mean, we got what Rand Paul had said during the early Republican primaries, what he was afraid of, a reality TV star for president. I mean, is that the best that we can do? And how has media helped shape that? How has our culture changed in such a way that this is what people saw as being ideal, you know, for our government? You know, love him or hate him, this is a strange period.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's a cipher, you know. You kind of hit the nail on the head where it's like, so people either think that he's got this this elaborate sort of like eight-dimensional chess game going on here where he's way ahead of, and there are people that think he's just a buffoon. So it's like, and it's like, I can see both sides of the arguments depending on the day where it's like, I don't know what this guy's deal is. He's really fascinating, you know, but it certainly seems to me like, you know, it's, I worry about the future of the country because, now, personally, I would prefer if he was not the president. So that's my own personal opinion, whatever. Sorry, folks who like him. Yeah. And so if it seems to me like they're trying to force him out of office, and therefore, like, which is essentially, unless he genuinely is pulling some shady shit going on here that he should be removed from office, it's like a coup. You know what I'm saying? It's a coup. They're going to try and take him out of office through the tsunami of bad news until he can't, you know, serve as the president anymore. And it's like, if you're an ardent Donald Trump fan, that's exactly how they're going to see this. And that makes me worried.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like, if 40% of the population believes that the deep state pulled off a coup to remove Donald Trump from office, man, Katie barred the door. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, there could be violence. There could be a real problem here. You know, it's like I don't like to say we could descend into a civil war just because I don't know. You know, the Civil War was like very cut and dry, thankfully, like along geographical lines. It's like I know they say about the Civil War, brother fought brother, but this would be like to the extreme, you know. This would be like neighbors fighting neighbors. There would be no geographical, there would be no battle lines. It would be just chaos.
Maybe the entire thing would be fault online.
Mm, well, yeah, and that would be great. Then no one's getting shot.
Well, yeah, but by that, what I mean again is that, you know, this part of the whole thing that has changed, and coming back to, you know, the idea of Russian conspiracies and things, part of what has changed about all this is that we are looking at a period where, again, rather than war, rather than secret agents and espionage in that capacity, I mean, people hack into computers. Hackers go in and electronically remove data, which they then reveal in some way. It is sent to an agency, you know, a very, what some might call unhinged and at very least certainly anarchistic agency or group like WikiLeaks. And this information, however it's obtained by them, is then released, and then chaos ensues. And so what I think part of what we're looking at here is that I don't know that you could really liken it to warfare by definition. But again, the leverages that the different state entities use against one another, rather than being spying in actual battle as in the past, what we're now kind of seeing is this cyber warfare, this espionage aspect that is carried out completely under cover of darkness and behind the scenes and online. And that is at the crux of the issue over all the conspiracies and things that are occurring right now politically in our country. And, you know, really, again, as we saw with the French election and the potential for Russian attempts at trying to get information there, we see it elsewhere in the world, too. So, again, that's the thing that I'm saying is that really, if this gets any weirder, I mean, I'm looking at the technology and what role it plays right now and how that will fit into the narrative. God forbid if things get any weirder than they already are. Let's hope that they don't. But this is already such a strange time for American politics. And really, I think just for, you know, human culture and society here in the West, especially in general.
Yeah, well, I think we're in a weird state where you talk about like the Hegelian dialect. It's like they're clearly presenting a problem in a sense where it's like the internet is rife with all kinds of problems now with the hacking and the malware thing that happened this week and everything. It's like part of me wonders if like in the future, if they aspire, they being, you know, the powers that be, who as we all know have no party, they're just kind of like looking out for keeping control over the world. If they aspire for like a controlled internet, and this is part of the problem, or if it's just gotten so wildly out of control that no one can really handle it. But it's like this there's a problem here with the internet. You can kind of see it becoming more of a problem, and it's like, what's the, are they going to offer for an answer? Like a new internet where you have to have, you have to use your name, like the anonymity of the internet will vanish because people can't be trusted anymore to use it. Like what's gonna happen? Who knows? Or yeah, I mean, or like there could be a situation, like it sounds like a Twilight Zone episode or something, but it's like where everybody's emails fucking get released. It's like no one has any secrets anymore, and the world is plunged into chaos because, you know, all these husbands find out their wives are cheating on them, and all the wives find out their husbands are cheating on them, and all kinds of shit comes out, and it's like, oh man, you know, the world, we had this incredible freedom, and now we've botched it.
Well, at that point, at least maybe we'd know a little something more about UFOs, or then again, maybe we wouldn't. I don't know.
Knowing UFOs, that's the joke too about Trump, where it's like, well, I've been making the joke for a while. Now everyone's saying it on Twitter. They're stealing my bit. It's, you know, if Trump knew about UFOs, he would slip up by now. So it's like, I'm now of the opinion they probably didn't tell him about UFOs.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, and the other thing, too, about that, as far as, like, good information, bad information, UFOs, and all the whole, the current political thing, this is kind of interesting to me, too. Tom DeLonge, former Blink-182, has recently kind of shifted in terms of the things he's tweeting about. DeLonge, you know, he made – well, first of all, there is this new book co-written with Peter Lavenda. I definitely want to read it and see what, you know, their historical analysis of the UFO phenomena appears to be. I reviewed the Secret Machines Volume 1 book that they did, Chasing Shadows, which is a novel, but it still was good, and I enjoyed it. But I won't say I'm unimpressed with Tom DeLonge. I like Tom. My brother Caleb actually worked for him for a short time. He actually impresses me quite a bit with some of his knowledge about UFOs. However, since the whole Secret Machines thing has happened, we obviously see that Tom has some legitimate interest, and not just that, but also some legitimate contacts as a result of, interestingly, WikiLeaks. I mean, that's maybe one of the less often discussed things. Yeah, as it all relates to WikiLeaks, I mean, you know, yeah, Tom DeLonge and emails that he sent to John Podesta did show up in those emails that were leaked. And what we find there is that, you know, he did say that he had someone, he did apparently want to bring somebody to Washington to meet with Podesta. I don't know that we can say so much as venture to guess that he had some sort of influence in terms of the Clinton campaign and their dealings, but he obviously at least was able to get an audience before Podesta and bring one of his alleged friends from within the government, you know, and who we suspect this was Major Neil McCaslin, who oversees like 11,000 employees there at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Science Division of the U.S. Air Force, and this individual seems to actually legitimately be working with Tom DeLonge. That much we seem to have gleaned. Now, recently, he has been tweeting saying, and he refers to this quote as a prophecy on Twitter, but he says that he believes that Trump will be impeached and that they're going to be taking this guy down, and it's going to be shown that he indeed had been involved with Russia and all this sort of stuff. But what's weird about DeLonge is that ever since around the time of the WikiLeaks release, he was posting on Instagram and places and saying WikiLeaks really messed some stuff up with that release. But, you know, even bigger, better things are going to happen. Wait 60 days, I think, was the time period that he said. And he says, watch, there's going to be a big announcement. Well, I think we waited for this big announcement. I don't recall ever seeing any big announcement apart from the fact that I saw a quick picture online the other day of this new book that Peter Lavenda, who I really respect, had co-authored. And, you know, but as far as Tom goes, you know, it's a little strange because I'm kind of waiting and watching and trying to see, okay, you keep saying big things on the way. We've got a big announcement coming out and everything. And people are really going to be shocked. And then all of a sudden he just starts making these prophecies about Trump, you know, and how he's going to be impeached and all these kind of things. And I'm like, what is Tom DeLonge really getting at? Who is allegedly giving him this information? Where is this stuff really coming from?
Right.
Yeah, I hate to say this, but you know, I am, I think, with time becoming a little less and less impressed by Tom. And when I reviewed his book, I initially and still maintain I had concerns that this was another one of these Project Beta kind of things all over again.
Project.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, I was really concerned that what we were seeing here was that just like the whole Benowitz affair, you know, that Tom DeLonge has basically been selected and he's been given bad information because they see him as the perfect person to start giving a lot of bad information out through a little media empire, this secret machines thing. Now, people have confronted him and asked him about that, and he says, look, no, this is not what's going on, you know, and I actually know a lot about this, and that's why these people trust me, and they appreciate what I'm doing, and that's why they're giving me this information. But by the same token, the rest of the world seems to be standing out here going, right, Tom DeLonge, they came to you. They came – why did they not go to Richard Dolan or to Stanton Friedman and say, you know, you – for your years of service to the UFO community, it's time you now know the truth. And we're going to select you to be our helper to release the information to the masses. Now, they go to Tom DeLonge, a guy who up until now, however serious it may have been for him by virtue of only having a personal interest and not having written books or anything up until now. I mean, he seemed to have at best a sort of a peripheral interest in UFOs, despite possessing a lot of knowledge, which Tom absolutely does. And I really like that about Tom. I would love to be able to have a chance to talk with him one-on-one. And see if our personal conversation would elucidate further any information that would convince me that the information he's been given is indeed accurate. But when he talks about meeting with these government agencies and secret, you know, people and them saying, you know, it all started in 1947, right after the war, and such and such and such. And then we found a body, a life form, you know, and he's, oh, and I'm just kind of like, this is starting to sound like that same old story, the old dangling carrot phenomena once again.
Right.
So I don't
right.
know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I danced with the disclosure tease last year. I was hopeful that things were turning around, and it's like it's funny though. It's for a while there was like three competing sort of like disclosure rumors earlier this year. There was also like what's his name? Grant Cameron was kind of mixed up in one. And then there was like a press release out of Canada that people were like, some UFO group was like, disclosure's imminent. Like, no, just sort of like without any real backing. So it's like, what the hell's going on here with this? Why are there three different groups sort of pushing disclosure? But to me, it's like, unless Trump comes out and has to throw the heat off of all this, and he's like, UFOs are real, okay? Let's talk about that. Fuck all this Russia shit. Let's talk about the UFO thing, which I'm part of me really still hopes he'll do, but I doubt that he even knows anything. It's like, I don't think the government is going to say anything because the world's just too fucking crazy right now. Like, the world, people can't handle any more crazy. You know what I mean?
That's
people cannot handle any more crazy.
That's one of the brilliant ironies about all this, though, is that, you know, people will acknowledge that Trump seems to be prone to conspiracy theories himself, admires Alex Jones, things like this, and yet he seems to show little or no interest in UFOs.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, meanwhile,
yeah,
his Democratic opponent in the last election, of course, was going on Jimmy Kimmel and shows like this and saying, well, we call it UAP now, okay? And Clinton and Podesta, they were very involved. And very hopeful in their attitudes about releasing more government information if any were to be found, and greater transparency on those issues. So it's quite interesting, in fact, that while we look at Trump as being the more conspiracy-prone individual, he wasn't the one that believed in UFOs. And I don't mean that as a slight against his opponent. I mean that's just rather ironic.
Yeah,
and furthermore,
weird. Well, the whole thing is weird because, you know, the whole thing is weird because no one fucking bothered to even, like, I think one person asked him and, like, he had no interest in it. It was, like, last April. But it's like no one – Hillary Clinton was in the news several times about UFOs. And considering how outspoken Donald Trump was about everything, no one ever brought it up. So to me, that shows that there's something weird there, you know what I mean? There's something, like, they didn't even want people talking about it, it felt like to me.
I don't know.
It's just weird. Now that I say that, though, then there was like a million mainstream articles about her saying shit. So it's like, what? Maybe it's like reporters don't want to ask him, don't want to bring it up, because like the reporters are the worst. They could have gotten to the bottom of this a long time ago. They blew it. So.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so maybe at the end of the day, the actual conspiracy is this, that because Clinton was vocal about wanting to be able to release information about UFOs, there was some sort of a operation to ensure that she wouldn't get in office. I'm just kidding. I don't believe that at all. I'll put things in a bit of perspective. I'm trying to be funny here, but in actual practice, when we look at past presidencies and what what certain presidents have said about UFOs, I think we can glean some things. You know, Barack Obama, of course, had said that, you know, you get all fired up about what might be out there at Area 51. And then when you actually hear the secrets, he says it's actually quite disappointing. You know, that was something that he had told, I believe, the HBO host. And it was quoted in a lot of different interviews and whatnot. But he referred to basically UFOs and conspiracies and stuff. The real information, he says, is disappointing. Bill Clinton, of course, had said that he had gone and he had tried to find information. And Jimmy Kimmel asking him, of course, because that's kind of Kimmel's shtick. That's an interesting thing in itself. I read a blog post for Mysterious Universe about this some time ago, and I'd said, really, if we want to nominate somebody for UFO Researcher of the Year, the Open Minds UFO Congress, you know, they had actually given the UFO Researcher of the Year award to Tom DeLonge this year.
Yeah.
And Tom?
Oh,
Tom,
I definitely agree. Give it to Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel has done something that no UFO investigator has managed to do.
Yeah.
He has, although you might say Grant Cameron has come fairly close with his UFOs and presidents, you know, research. He's got a great website about that, but I think
Jimmy Kimmel's
the only person
talked to the actual presidents.
He has before a live television audience on more than one occasion. He has sat down. He has asked Barack Obama. He has asked George W. Bush. He has asked Hillary Clinton, who was not president but who was a leading candidate last year. He asked her husband and former president. Who else has asked that many former presidents, current standing president Barack Obama, and then also – and again, you know, most of them took a fairly nonchalant or even whimsical attitude toward it. The one who was the most tight-lipped about it was George W. Bush. He said he essentially said, Jimmy, I'm not going to say a word. I'm not telling you a thing. Barack Obama kind of laughed about it and said that's what they want you to think. But you'll remember Bill Clinton said, yeah, I went looking and when asked if you had found anything, would you have told us about it? Yeah, I would, is what Bill Clinton said. So it's quite interesting, the varieties of different interactions and different attitudes that these former and current commander-in-chiefs at the time of the interviews, what they actually said and how they responded to that question. And good on Jimmy Kimmel for being the only guy in the media who will go to a former or current president and say, look, guys, let's talk about the white elephant in the room here, okay? UFOs, yay, nay, what do you think? But what do we learn from those interactions? Well, number one, that the presidents, some of them do seem to have a tendency toward more transparency, probably the Clintons. It seems that some presidents are more, if they did know something, they would be less inclined to talk about it due to coming back to what we talked about earlier, their oath to the country and to, you know, the swearing to secrecy, as we saw with George W. Bush. Now,
right.
Barack Obama doesn't seem to indicate an overt interest in these kind of things, but I'll note that throughout his presidency, he mentioned such things as UFOs, aliens, and Area 51 more than any other president in the past that I can recall. Second behind him had been Bill Clinton, who I argue had more interest than Obama. But again, although in passing and typically as a joke, Obama mentioned that subject more than anybody during his presidency. He was the first president, I think, that while in office more than once mentioned Area 51.
I think he was the first. I think they first acknowledged the existence of it during his administration. It was something, some kind of technicality like that, where it was like they had kind of blown it off until they finally officially recognized it while he was president. So
it was a historical document that was released by the CIA. I don't know if Gerald Haynes, the former chief CIA historian, had authored that, but it had been a commemorative document discussing the U-2 spy planes and the programs and whatnot. And it, although not explicitly related to Area 51, made official mention of the Groom Lake facility in the document, which was released and therefore, as a result, by proxy, officially presented. It gave us the first actual presentation of documentation that mentioned specifically the Groom Lake facility we know as Area 51. So, yeah, that information did come out during Obama's presidency, which is kind of interesting. You know, I remember talking with the UFO skeptic Bob Schaefer one time, in fact, at the UFO Congress back in 2013. I said, I think that there are certain aircraft in our employ that account for these UFO reports, a lot of them, maybe these big triangles and things. And he says, you believe that? And I said, well, sure I do. And I said, come on, that's got to be more plausible, Bob, than the idea that aliens are flying around. And he says, well, I don't buy that. And he says, the reason why I don't buy that is because if there were secret aircraft that had been in operation, this many decades later, we would have known about that by now. That information would have been released. And then shortly after that discussion, of course, is when the information released about known aircraft also divulges the first public acknowledgement of Area 51. Again, we all knew it was out there, It's not like anybody was saying Area 51 didn't exist, but there was no official record or any kind of information presented publicly about it, and then that document is released. And seemingly inconsequential though that is, it does go to show that from time to time information is released to the public. And at other times, like the documents I'm talking about from 2015, where we see evidence of, you know, again, notations describing spy plane activities operating over the Pacific Ocean, but we don't get the names of one of the aircraft. What about that does not seem to indicate that there was an aircraft employed by the U.S. Air Force or some similar agency, presumably the Air Force? It was in operation, and it is off the records. There are records that have been released about its activities, minimal though they are, but very clearly the name of that aircraft being redacted. We don't know what that aircraft is. Is this the fabled Project Aurora? I mean, there are a lot of people, and I've got friends in the aerospace industry who say, look, I think that's all a conspiracy. I don't think that there was a Project Aurora. But I definitely think that there have been aircraft, and there are still aircraft that are in use and in employ, but that are not public knowledge. And I do not think that it's naive to suppose that there are things that our government keeps from us like that.
Yeah, well, we talked about this last time you were on the show about how I think that more recent, but not like within the last few years, it's hard to explain, like 90s era UFO sightings and early aughts may have been drone technology that the government was perfecting, because now everybody can get a drone, so that would indicate that the government had drones way earlier, and therefore they were probably UFOs at the time. I'd love for someone to go back and look into that, but I'm too lazy to do. I'm too busy.
Tangent to that, I can definitely tell you that I think drone technologies began to see use in the 1930s. And I know people are like, what? But no, I'm serious. Remotely controlled aircraft that were unmanned, they had first been used, not anything comparable to, like, you know, what we see these days, the XS-7B or whatever, you know, that the Navy operates, you know, these tailless small aircraft that are roughly shaped like a stealth fighter, but, you know, if actually seen in profile and flying quickly by, I mean, they might actually resemble a saucer vaguely in shape. Some of these drones, then you have others that look a little bit more like a typical aircraft, like the Predator drones of fame, used in the bombings and whatnot. But however you want to look at it, again, drones that were in no way as sophisticated as what we have today have existed. I mean, drone by definition just being an unmanned aerial vehicle, and there have been target drones and things like that that have been used for decades. So, yeah, I mean, that – but see, those aircraft did not in any way look anomalous. They would not have been something that would have seemed otherworldly or atypical. I mean, these kind of aircraft very much resembled, well, you know, conventional aircraft. Smaller ones probably more like hobby planes and things like that. I've actually gone in fact, this Thursday I'm going to be going down to the Greenville Aerodrome, where one of the largest recreational aircraft, hobby aircraft events occurs every year. And my friend Susan is associated with that, and my band. Well, I'm not playing as much with my acoustic group these days. I'm focusing much more on research and podcasting, which is a good thing. But the few shows that I still do are events like this, and this is an annual one. But it's one of the largest, remote-controlled aircraft, you know, hobby plane events that there is in the country. And it's crazy because you're standing out there at night, and you're looking out over the lake, and you're seeing all these glowing neon lights dancing in the sky. I mean, it's very much like if you didn't know what you were looking at, you would see these things and go, my gosh, wow, look at that UFO. These things have been around for years.
Exactly, yeah. Well, one thing I was sort of different, want to pivot to a different point here in a sense is, I'm not sure if we talked about this before, but if we did, then I don't remember it, so I want to talk about it again. but it's funny, we're about the same age. It's like as I was going along in the beginning years of the show, a lot of times I was saying, you know, when the younger generation comes along, we're going to, you know, as we get older, and it's going to be a generational thing, this UFO thing, and people are going to be more open to the idea. And yeah, people are more open to the idea, don't get me wrong, but it's like there's a real weird sort of magic trick that came into play, I think. They talk about like social engineering, how they're like, they're preparing us, but it's like, if you really take a step back, it's like when this thing kind of first came along, people were like, what's going on? What is this thing? And like, it hasn't changed to the point now where people have just outright accepted. It's become like a punchline. It's become a thing where, like, people accept it, They don't even know, not necessarily even accept whether or not UFOs are real. They just accept that they're never going to be told, that there's a cover, the cover-up is what's become accepted in a sense. And it's very unfortunate, I think. It's frustrating in a way, because it's like, that's the you talk about how like ETH has taken hold in the minds of people that UFOs are aliens. It's like an additional layer that has taken hold in the minds of the public, I think. That they just say, oh, well, screw it. They'll never let us know. Oh, the government's covering it up. Ha, ha, ha. And it's like, man, this isn't a joke. I wish people cared, but I think they kind of like were tricked somehow, you know, so social engineering in a way.
That's an interesting discussion that we could have, and you know, we can definitely touch on that here. But heck, you could spend an hour or two talking about that alone. Peter Robbins has often talked with me in the past about what he calls the UFO ridicule factor and kind of tracking that down. It's interesting because I think that there's enough general knowledge in the public of a UFO, and let me be clear in stating what a UFO is supposed to be. Okay? People see shows like Ancient Aliens, and this is an interesting thing. This is one of the big reasons I don't do a lot of television. I over the years, have done a couple of little TV things, and at one time, back when I was a less critical thinker, I was okay with going on a television show and doing a segment on ghost hunting or something like that because I found this stuff interesting. And these days, first of all, there's this culture of like the reality TV thing. Talk about a reality TV star for president. I mean, the whole reality TV phenomena, the idea that every show has to be this supposedly unscripted and reality-based thing, when in fact it's all incredibly manufactured. I mean, people have to go and they try out for these shows and they're essentially told what to wear and what they're supposed to say. I find that so remarkably distasteful, and that's why I won't, again, many mistake the aspiring television star with some interest in UFOs, might even be a so-called quote-unquote expert, but they still are more an aspiring star than they are a UFO expert. Skeptics even will mistake those so-called experts for being people who are actually experts in this phenomena. You know, when I see somebody look at the Ancient Aliens stars, and there I've got some friends who've been on that show, don't get me wrong, but when people look at a show like that and they say that, well, all of these people are representative of what that community calls their experts, and then you come talk to myself, you know, do I look at all those people and say, yeah, that each one of those guys, including the crazy one with the hair, that they're experts? I don't consider that an expertise, and I certainly don't consider those views to be views which in any way reflect my own. Let's just name him. Let's just say Giorgio Tsoukalos, okay? Can we say that? Can I do that?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want. I don't care.
Giorgio Tsoukalos. And the reason why I'm going to go ahead and say that, I mean, come on, you know, I can say the guy with the hair, but let's just drop all this naming names for a minute, because I, back in 2012, worked with a fella, and Giorgio was one of the people who was hired to come and speak at an event that I participated in. And I was not a huge fan of Ancient Aliens at that time, but at that point, you know, it seemed like an interesting thing to be involved with. And since that time, my skepticism has greatly deepened. I haven't remained in touch with Giorgio Tsoukalos by any means, and I don't know that he even would remember me or you know, let alone know who I am. But it's funny because for the mainstream public, I mean, I've at least had – what I'm saying is I've had enough interactions with him, and I can, I think – fairly say, I even interviewed him at one point, and that interview aired on the Grayling Report podcast. I found that I had a lot of things in common with him, and also found that there were a lot of things I just didn't agree with him about. But for the general public who may not really be interested in UFOs, but have sort of a, you know, general idea of what they're supposed to be, they would look at a show like Ancient Aliens, and they would turn that on and see the guy with the hair, as they know him, okay, and they would hear what Giorgio or somebody says, and they would be like, okay, so this is what those UFO people believe. And then skeptics not only attack those people under the apparently mistaken impression that those are the actual experts that this community holds as being the people with the most knowledge about this stuff. And yeah, it's easy. It's like shooting fish in a barrel, disproving those ideas. No, I don't look at those guys as, with all due respect to Giorgio, let him be a television star and let him be successful. That's fine. You know, I support that. And if he wants to do that, that's fine. You know, I wish him well. I really do. I hope he does great, and I hope he gets everything out of life that he wants. But on intellectual grounds, it's also fine, and I know he would be okay with me saying, you know, I disagree with you. You know, he'd say, fine, that's great. I'm going to laugh all the way to the bank. You know, you disagree with me all you want to. No bad blood there, right? that is not a, first of all, UFO skeptic or UFO expert. That, to me, does not represent what UFO researchers and believers believe. I don't think that skeptics who attack that and say that that's what these people believe are right when they say that this is a UFO investigator and we've got to tear down what he believes. I think that there's this entirely ridiculous misconception about what quote-unquote UFO researchers and believers actually believe based on what they see on television. I don't think that what we see on television is any fair representation whatsoever of what serious, disciplined researchers who try to apply a bit of science to what they do. And yes, I will say, like myself, I do try to be science-minded, critical-minded, skeptical, but nonetheless open to the possibility that there are varieties of phenomena, I guess we could say, that constitute, in the broader sense, UFO reports, which are worthy of scientific study. But none of that is reflected by the television side of it. None of that is reflected, unfortunately, I think, by even the critical attitudes that are often launched at UFOs. And when I read a skeptic, they'll say, but come on, do you really believe that there are alien little green men coming down? I say, look, that could be further. It could not be further from what I actually think about this phenomenon. Let's actually get down to what I'm talking about. And at the end of the day, we end up, the skeptics and I, you know, sitting down and saying, oh, wow, okay, so you don't believe alien visitors necessarily are coming to Earth. You don't rule out that possibility. I don't think anybody really does, but we don't see evidence of that. Let's see here. Okay, you think that natural phenomena might constitute UFO reports. Gosh, wow, this is weird. We're in complete agreement. But see, how often do people sit down and hash it out and say, well, what do you really believe? What do we have in common? I don't call myself a UFO believer, and yet you do, and yet you say that you actually agree with me. There's got to be some sort of a breakdown here. We right. can't both agree on most of the fundamental points here, and yet you call yourself a UFO advocate, whereas I call myself a UFO skeptic. How does that work? You see what I'm saying here? So, I mean,
yeah,
the problem
yeah.
is
well,
we've got
to, yeah, it takes two to tango. So
it does.
Yeah.
And we've got to understand the differences between what is actual good research versus what people call this is what the UFO people believe. You know, when it's on television, I think most of the time you can actually rule that out. And again, you know, with more power to the Ancient Alien stars and Giorgio and people, if they want to go out there and be on television and talk about what they talk about. But I'm saying to a skeptical public who thinks that that is what UFOs are about, you know, you may not have educated yourself about what real UFO researchers actually think about those subjects. If you saw it on television, I can 9 times out of 10 tell you that what you saw probably is not a good representation of what real scientists and real researchers think about that subject.
Yeah, well, honestly, I'll be completely honest. Ancient Aliens, never seen an episode. Doesn't interest me.
Well,
I never I know people that have been on it. I know I've heard it a million times. I've seen the meme of Giorgio, but I think maybe I put it on for like 5 minutes just to see, you know, what it was, but I've never even watched a full episode from beginning to end. It sounds awful.
I have many years ago, back when I still had a television, I haven't owned a TV for about 6 years. I will watch.
And I'm like a TV snob, so.
Are you? Yeah, well, I am too. Like, for instance, I have Netflix, and I'll watch Netflix on a computer from time to time. So I definitely will engage in a bit of binge watching. But I think that there are also some really good quality programs as far as fiction, you know, like the Marvel shows, Daredevil, Jessica Jones, you know, Luke Cage. Extraordinary. Those shows are extraordinary. And I like classic shows like Twin Peaks and things like that, or going even further back, you know, Twilight Zone, stuff like that. I love Sherlock and almost anything the BBC does, and it's no secret at all that I'm a fan of Doctor Who.
Yeah, but we know you love the Doctor Who.
Yeah, but I don't think I've ever, like yourself, I remember seeing segments and things about Ancient Aliens, but I've never actually sat down and been like, oh, right, Ancient Aliens is coming on, and really watched an episode.
Who are these people watching?
Well, that's what's interesting. Again, we must make the distinction there. People like you and I who are trying to offer serious commentary about these subjects, and yet we're not attracted to Ancient Aliens and shows like that at all. I'll try and watch some of these UFO TV shows, and I think that's another big reason why I don't do these shows myself. They're like, oh, this guy's an expert, so let's get him on one of our reality TV shows, and let's tell him, you know, what he's going to say and how he's going to dress and what tree he's going to climb up and film and claim where he saw a UFO and stuff. You know, I mean, I'm not very interested in being on a show if I'm not interested
right, yeah,
in watching
yeah.
it. You know, if
yeah.
the programming.
Why would you want to endorse a product you don't use? Yeah, exactly. If like, yeah, I don't get invited on any shows, but if I was, I'd be like, nah, I think I'm all right. That's not exciting to me. That sounds more like a pain. Yeah.
Because you're real. You know, you're not a bullshitter. You're not, and I'm not. You know, again, I'm not saying that everybody who shows up on a TV show is a bullshitter. And like we've already said, I know people, and I've had friends on Ancient Aliens, and I may agree nearly 100% with something that somebody who goes on Ancient Aliens says, but I could also sit down and have a beer with them, and we can be friends. I mean, I've got a lot of friends.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, you know, having that in-law or that neighbor, you know, who's on the other side of the political fence, and you guys love each other because, you know, you've been friends for years and stuff, and you don't have a thing in common. If you get together with them and have that beer on a Saturday night, all you do is you debate, but you love the debate, and it's all in good fun, and you have fun with it. And, you know, that's the whole thing, is I think that it's okay for people who have different ideas and worldviews, and they want to, you know, they might debate in a friendly and spirited way, but they see at the end of the day that they're friends. I feel that way about a lot of my friends, whether those who appear on television or those who, you know, operate and who are the serious researchers in the community. I feel that way about a lot of them. As I've changed and grown and become not so much more cynical, but certainly more skeptical about a lot of these things over the years, I've had to move past and move away from just wanting to be the next guy who's written 10 or 12 books about UFOs and is famous for being that guy who wrote 10 or 12 books about UFOs. And that's my big claim to fame. I don't really care that much about fame that can be claimed, but I definitely believe in the truth. And I'm still interested in these kind of subjects, but my attitudes have evolved, like Graham Hancock said earlier today. It's okay for somebody's attitudes to evolve. And for any, again, not skeptic, but I'll say a snarktic, any debunker who wants to make a career out of being a blogger who just makes fun of people, and they want to sit back and laugh at people and say, well, you said this back in 2013, but now you say this. This doesn't add up. Well, you know what? Guess what? Ideas do change. People's attitudes and their beliefs do change. If we are being effective as skeptics and educators, we're going to help other people to change their attitudes and their preconceptions and their biases about things with good data. And we're going to hope for more of it as it relates to these subjects in the future. I hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. You want to keep going for a little while, or how are you feeling?
Man, I'm fine. I'm wide open. I mean, if you want to keep going, if you got stuff you'd like to talk about, you know, I wonder at this hour, I might, could we take like 1 minute and grab a water or something like that?
Sure, grab a water and I'll talk to the audience.
Talk to the audience for a minute, and yeah, if people, I mean, if and with the if they want to field some questions or something, I'm fine to go. But yeah, I'm going to just grab my water bottle real quick and we'll keep rolling.
All right, freshen up, and we'll continue the conversation for a little while longer, if you don't mind. I mean, I'm just chilling, hanging out, chatting with you, so I'm like, shit, we might as well keep going, so if you don't mind.
I don't mind, and in fact, I'm in the mood, so we might as well. I've had enough tea today that I'm awake, I'm alert, and I think I'm ready to go. So, yeah, let me refill the water bottle while you deliver a brief monologue, and then we'll pick up there here in a minute or so, okay?
Awesome. Sounds good.
All right.
Cool. There you go. There goes Micah. He's taking care of business. Let me see. Next week on the show, it's Bigfoot Portal 2, The Revenge. Adam Davies is back on the program. I believe it's his first time on the show since the infamous Bigfoot Portal episode. So that's going to be exciting because we're going to revisit that. So people who have questions about the Bigfoot Portal, you know, I went out for drinks with Adam in San Diego like a month ago, and he was really adamant that there's really like no reason to call it a Bigfoot portal, but it's become known as that, probably through my fucking antics, probably because of me. But it's going to be the Bigfoot. We're going to revisit that story because I've had a lot of time to think about it, and Adam's been through a lot since then, and so we're going to catch up with Adam. This program has been sort of like, we were laughing about it in San Diego, this program has been kind of like charting the remarkable course of Adam Davies' incredible career in this field of weirdness, and so and it's gotten even weirder, folks, and he's going to talk about that next week on the show, and we're going to revisit the Bigfoot portal, and that's going to be 10 p.m. Eastern time next Tuesday night. What is that? May 23rd. So the train keeps chugging along. Is Micah here?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I'm here.
There you go. All right. Plug your things just for the live audience, because we're going to lose them, but the rest can catch us on the MP3.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's always good to give something to those diehard podcasters, because as you know, having done this for a lot longer than I have as far as podcasting, I mean, literally, I think I've been podcasting about half as long as you have. I remember year after year, we would always look and we would see that Banal of America, yet again, another year, best podcast of the year. You know, so you, dude, you've done this for a long time. And I've got to give you props. I mean, hell, I wrote a book about podcasting, The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting. There are very few people who, you know, not only can I say had been doing it a lot longer than me, but people who helped me launch my radio appearances. The very first radio show I ever went on was a little show called Dobie Maxwell's Mothership, which was an actual live radio program. I just did a little quick thing that night on his show. But the first time I ever went on a podcast, if memory serves, I think one of the very first podcast interviews I ever did. I think the first was your podcast. Yours was
the
first
interview.
Podcast.
It might have been your first like intense interview like this, where where it's like a long chunk of time.
Yeah, I mean, I worked in radio at that time, and so it wasn't unusual for me. I was used to being involved in conversations on the microphone, so it wasn't weird. But that was definitely my first podcast interview. So I actually, really, we might say, I had my first experience with podcasting with you. So yeah, I definitely got to give you props, dog. I got to give you big props.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. Well, it's been great chatting with you over the years, and you know, I'm not wrapping things up for the show. I'm just sort of putting this seasonal thing to bed and coming up with some new ideas and new takes on podcasting, I hope, because I've been doing it for so long, so I want to try and have a reset and a refresh. But, you know, in this weird sort of like box set that is the way I've been doing the show all these years, it's been great chatting with all you these years, man. It's been awesome. So it's been awesome to watch you rise through, you know, it's like we were joking about Alex Jones as like an A-list celebrity. It's like, you know, you and I, we sort of cut our teeth right early at the same time in this field. It's been kind of fun, you know, watching each other grow, you know, in this field. It's been fun, you know. So a lot of folks, when I first got into this, they were like, you know, it's like, oh, Stan Friedman, Rich Dolan, holy shit, you know. And then there were other folks that were like on my level, you know what I mean? Like young guys who were just getting into this, and you were one of those guys. So it's been fun to, like, watch each other move up the weird ranks of the paranormal, you know, to the point where now people are like, look at us that way or something. I hope some folks do, you know, and it's like, it's just cool.
It is cool. I mean, definitely friends and colleagues here just kicking back. And that's the fun thing is there are some interviews, as you know, both for a interviewer or for the person being interviewed. The interviewee, I guess, as we might say. I mean, there is definitely that aspect where certain interviews, there's a lot more work that goes into it. You know, certain guests will require you to read their book before, literally, will say, you know, don't have me on your show.
Oh, yeah, I've had a couple of guests like that. Yeah, I've had a couple of guests.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a fair question. And, you know, I've had a few guests that I wouldn't have had them on had I not read their entire book. Then there are certain guests who, just in the interest of time, you know, you can't read that entire book. And then there's certain hosts, when as a guest I go on their show, they'll tell me, you know, look, we're not reading your book, you know, you give us 20 questions and we're going to ask you the questions that you prepare for us, and we'll dance around it, and we'll do some stuff, and we'll throw you a curveball every now and then, but I mean, fundamentally, we want this interview to go smoothly, so you tell us what you want to be asked. My favorite of all the varieties of interviews are like what you and I do, which is there is very little show prep. It's like, what do you want to talk about? This, that, and that. Okay, cool. I'll call you at 9 on Tuesday, and then we roll for a couple of hours.
Yeah, exactly.
And go. And again, you know I've mentioned him a lot today, but I mean, another guy who in this community deserves props, Joe Rogan, has been kicking mortal ass. He kicked so much ass. And what I love about that guy is he didn't care if it's Michael Shermer or if it's Neil deGrasse Tyson or who's in his studio. He's like, hold on just a second, Neil, because really that could be bullshit, right? And he will call bullshit, or he will get right up with somebody toe-to-toe, but never ever comes across as being confrontational. Never ever.
I'll have
ever
to check it out. I haven't heard his show, but I'm hearing a lot of good things tonight, but I've been hearing good things for a while about his show. So
I was erroneously under the impression, the very mistaken impression, that Joe Rogan was just a meathead. He's just this, you know, a comedian and this, you know, this muscle guy. And, you know, he speaks very plainly, and he doesn't try to, you know, he doesn't use a lot of 50-cent words or anything like that. And I, you know, even though, because I do talk about a lot of science, there are from time to time instances where I'll have to drop some scientific lingo and some things like that. But I always kind of back.
You enjoy you like the 75-cent words, cut the shit.
Well, see, I don't want to be known as somebody who just tries to use big words.
No,
I mean,
no, dude, you're
again,
eloquent. You're eloquent. I was going to say, you put me over so much. I'm going to interrupt you, put you over, because, you know, you say you don't want to go on these shows. You would make a killing if you just get the fuck out of ufology and the paranormal. You could host, like, one of these reality shows. You're you know, you got the factor to you, man. You got, you know, it's a ufology is lucky that we still have you. At this point, because I think you have so much immense talent that you could, if you went out to Hollywood, you'd be like, it'd be like how The Rock left wrestling. That's what I think it would be like. That's the closest comparison I can make. So we're lucky to have you in this field, because you could be like the Rock of ufology if you were like, hey, let me pursue something outside of this crazy carny world that we operate in, as a, you know, the conspiracy pool we swim in.
And I will be honest, I've got some projects in the work right now, and without saying too much, I can definitely say that you know, one of my dear friends, Jason Pentrail, is involved in a lot of this stuff, and he had literally just been saying to me earlier today, he's like, you know, I think that I'm seeing you, Micah, begin to outgrow all that, and I hope I continue to see you move beyond all that. And I think that there's a part of me that, you know, especially for shows like this, because you could call it a sentimental attachment. You know, well, he was my first podcast, and I'll always go back to Binal. I wish I could quit you, but but you know.
I wish more. I wish more people thought that way. My life would be great.
Well, I really value your opinions on things and our friendship, and I love coming on your show for that very reason. And I hope that people who listen to our show, that much like what I find appealing about Joe Rogan, is that it's not this, tell us a little bit about your background and how you became involved. I mean, no, Jones is like, so man, thank you for coming over here, man, dude. Let's talk about some shit. And he'll say it
exactly.
You know, and I've kind of learned over time that, you know, I speak a certain way. I have a lot of interest, and therefore, you know, like you mentioned, the 75-cent words, they're going to come out from time to time, but I don't do that to try and sound smart. I talk about the shit that interests me. And if somebody else, you know, there's this poor guy, God love him, and I hope he's having a better time doing what he's doing right now than he would be listening to us. You know, my tweets, you know, I'm seeing a lot of tweets here, but, you know, one of them here is, what was the tweet? I have a lot of MX Unexplained podcasts to catch up on, so I'll use this hole in my podcast time wisely. The same guy who was bitching because I came on this show. Oh, I'm so offended because there's a host or a guest who's coming on Binal's show tonight that I don't agree with, and so I can't be challenged. I can't be triggered. I got to go and listen to something else. But, you know, if I hear about this again from this individual, it's going to be because he couldn't resist himself and he had to come and listen again. So, hey, if you're there before you get burned again, just understand I hear you. I feel you. And it's okay if you don't agree with things I say, or anybody listening right now, if that individual didn't eventually come back because Micah Hanks was so horrible he couldn't listen to it. I really care about what people think, but I don't care enough about people's attitude about me that I worry about that. I do find it concerning when somebody feels that something that someone else says makes them so uncomfortable or challenges their views on things so much that they will not listen to that podcast. You feel so challenged by what you've heard that you won't even approach that subject. So for me, you know, I think that I try to challenge myself, and I do kind of see myself moving a little away from this community. But I think that there are certain shows like this, and there are certain subjects like UFOs that I will also always come back to, but I'm not going to do it the same old way that so many people do. And if I'm branded goofy for being somebody who does that and says those kind of things, well, you know, well, you can call me goofy. You can call me credulous.
I've never heard anyone call you goofy. I don't know what.
I don't know.
I would describe you as goofy. I'm goofy.
Everybody, you know, I like being goofy sometimes. You know, one of the things that people like about podcasts, again, Joe Rogan, he's a comedian part of the time when he's not hosting what I think has, in my opinion, become one of the best podcasts. And I have come to appreciate it as being one of the best podcasts. Period. Not only podcasts of its kind, but you got to also keep in mind the diversity of the guests. He doesn't really just do like the weird stuff. He doesn't just do politics. He doesn't just do any one thing. He will get celebrities on. He'll talk about science. He'll talk about the unexplained. He'll talk. Dude, he is so diverse, and very few podcasters can do what Joe Rogan does, let alone do it as well as he does, and be able to go toe to toe with almost anybody on any subject, but always be friendly and always sound like he's just right there with them. Dude, the guy has talent.
You got to get on this guy's show. He sounds like you're Have you contacted him and tried to be on a show? I don't even listen to his show. So much like the, and this is not a diss on him. I hate to draw the comparison, but I this is some media I don't consume, like the Ancient Aliens. I don't really listen to the Joe Rogan podcast. So, but I'm hearing good things about it. So maybe I'll start. But you should try to get on his show, dude. I'm sure he'd love to talk to you.
The truth though is, I never try to go on a show. That's my thing though. The truth is,
I never really asked to be on any shows either. So you just let them come to you.
I when I was younger, I'd maybe pitch to people and be like, yeah, you know, man, I'd love to, you know, be on your show. And again, 9 times out of 10, what happens is when you try and pitch, you know, hey, I'm a such and such author of so many books and blah 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 blah, and I do this and that. And those people never get back with you, you know. And then I get to a certain point after years and years of just saying, you know, fuck all this. I'm just going to be who I am. I'm going to talk about what interests me. You know, I used to, for the longest time, also would never, ever, ever drop an F-bomb like you just heard. And what changed, again, was I'm not trying to sound more like Joe Rogan or whoever, because he'll do that from time to time. And I don't do it on my own podcast. I will say that, because on my own podcast, I know it to be a very family-friendly atmosphere, and I have parents who write in and say, I really appreciate the fact that you keep it clean, and I'll always keep Grayley and Report clean. But man, you know, if I'm on a show like this with you and I have a host who is using,
speaking freely,
yeah, and I'm telling you, obviously there's an atmosphere for it, and I want not to try and fit in. I want merely to say whatever's on my mind and be completely honest and real. That's a good podcast. And again, that's what's great about Joe and Mary. Very, very few other podcasts, but yes, truly, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, yours is one of them. It's very real, very unfiltered, and there's very real discussion. It's not a bunch of scripted junk. And so be who you are. Drink as much tea as you want if you're like me, and get all, you know, geared up and ready to go, and just say what's really on your mind, because that's what is beautiful about the podcast. That's what differentiates it from this reality TV. What a great paradox. We call that reality TV, and there's nothing realistic about it at all.
Nothing. Right, it's so lavishly overproduced and everything, and the stuff we do is fairly raw. We're just making audio files, yeah, man. we're as basic as the shit that was out there, like in the 20s or whenever they managed to first record sound. It's like it's as basic a form of communication as you can conjure.
But that's what's beautiful about it, Benal. Couple of guys, a couple of microphones, roll tape, let's go. And that is, people keep trying to analyze podcasts. They're like, why is this so popular? How has this, and I have, you know, again, my good pal Jason Pentrail, who I'm working with on a lot of projects right now, and some stuff I don't talk about very much publicly yet, but you'll, of course, hear about it plenty in the future. But, you know, also, I got to point out that this guy is like an intellectual brother to me, and, you know, someone who's one of these rare individuals who comes along and is able to educate me about a lot of facets of science, history, archaeology, and things, and has really in many ways become an incredible mentor to me, which is funny because when you're talking about, you know, kind of leaving the, what would happen if you got out of this community and went on to do different things? And that's exactly what he and I were talking about earlier. And yeah, that's kind of, I think, an inevitability, because yes, my ideas evolve and change, and I find different interests with time, and many of us do. I do see so many like UFO researchers and people that they found their little niche and they get stuck in that rut, and it's okay. I'm not telling anybody they can't make a living doing what they do, but unfortunately I see a lot of people in this community who it's more about, well, what will my next book be about? Because I got to get another book out because I've got to be the guy who has a lot of books, whether that be for financial reasons. I mean, again, I've found that if you're in this community and you're writing books and trying to sell them, you're probably not making a huge living. If you know, there are a lot of things you could do.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
For money. Yeah, there are a lot of things that would make you more money than writing books about UFOs and things like that. And so that's why I laugh when people say, you just do this. You just write books just because you know you'll make money. Uh-huh. God, yeah. I know the tens of dollars that I make selling UFO books. Now, I write about the subjects that I find interesting, and I write what I believe about those subjects. And my beliefs and my attitudes have changed greatly within the last 2 years. I can look at books that I wrote as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, and I find that maybe half of what I wrote, I may not say I disagree with, but I definitely have changed my views about a lot of those subjects. And if you're not growing and evolving, changing and learning, what good are you? What good is life if it's not throwing new experiences at us, you know? And there are some great venerable researchers in the UFO community who have, for the last 40 years, given the same lecture every weekend, You know, they talk about the same subjects. They hit the same talking points. And every time they go on a podcast, they're talking about the same subject and offering the same views and the same historical factoids about that subject. They really kind of, unfortunately, have become the one-trick pony. And respected though they are for what they do, again, for me, life is about learning and experiencing new things and doing new things. And maybe, just maybe, we could also say that for the researcher who is too well-known for redundancy, we could come back at them and say that maybe the hosts who have interviewed them have failed in asking a diverse enough set of questions, if that makes
Absolutely.
Sense.
Absolutely. Are you talking about Stan? Because Stan gets the rap because of and I know that Stan is always sort of tagged as that, and people always complain when I have him on the show and stuff. And it's like, to me, Stan's like the fucking Rolling Stones. He's a rock star. So to me, it's like, I want to hear Give Me Shelter and Paint It Black.
That's a good
one. It's weird. Like
I
that.
Love those songs. And every time the songs come on, you want to hear them. Now, I will say this about Stanton, though. Stanton does I don't know if redundancy is the thing. See, I've never had that problem with Stan because when I talk to Stan, I'm like, Stan, did you know Alan Hendry? Oh, did I know him? I knew him very well. He was
yeah, exactly. That's the thing that people don't – exactly. That's what people don't realize about Stan, too. They make that criticism, and then it's like, no, but if you talk to him, he's got an amazing wealth of insight and stories. It's just like no one wants him to come and give a fucking presentation on Alan Hendry and – You know, no one wants to talk to him about what it was like going on all these TV shows in the 70s and shit. Like, but he has these insights. He just doesn't really ever get the opportunity to share them in a lot of ways because people want to hear
exactly.
the greatest hits.
The discussions I've had with Stanton Friedman last February, I think I told you about this. You know, he and I were picked up at the airport for an event that we were doing up in Big Bear Lake, California, and we had to ride a couple of hours up through the beautiful mountains of California. And so imagine. We stopped for lunch in Riverside, and we talked about, we talked about all kinds of stuff. We talked about whether Philip J. Klass might have had a government clearance and did some secret work. We talked about Alan Hendry. We talked about Einstein. I mean, Stanton Friedman is like an expert on Einstein, and nobody ever asks him about that. Like, dude, Stanton Friedman is such a – he has such an incredible wealth of knowledge, and there wasn't a single question about science that I could ask him. They said, well, I just really don't know anything about that. I mean, he has so much – information. Well, I think you got to remember about Einstein. I mean, he could do it like nobody's business. But sitting there and talking with him in Riverside and having like pastrami sandwiches was one of the most incredible things I've ever experienced. And he is such an incredible, respectful, delightful person. But yeah, he is one of the most knowledgeable people that I think I've ever met. And in Stan's instance, no, what I really would say is that, you know, if people find him to be redundant or anything like that, it's only because I think that there are a wealth of subjects that he is absolutely expert on, but everybody goes for the UFOs. I try to talk about – I don't talk about things that are not necessarily UFO-related when I talk to him, but I ask him about people in the UFO community, and I ask him about
like
his interactions.
Very specific details and stuff like that. Yeah, exactly. That's how I try to talk to him, too.
Yeah, yes, you do. You always, like, again, you know, bringing up the fake news thing. And that was one of the most entertaining segments, getting his perspective on that when you sent me that. Because, again, you ask him stuff that nobody asked him. And here's the other thing, too. I asked him about Carl Sagan, okay? Have you heard the Sagan story?
I don't know. I don't recall a Sagan story. So what is the Sagan story?
This is fascinating. I mean, he told me that he visited Carl Sagan shortly before Sagan's death. Okay, and that because he was giving a lecture up that way, and he said, and again, this is pretty well known. I didn't know that they had actually known each other really well, and I'd asked him. I said, you know, I understand that you and Sagan were in the same graduating class there at Chicago University. He says, oh, I knew him very well, you know. And so he says, in fact, shortly before his death, he said, I was invited over for tea at his house because I was speaking there in the area, and I go over to his house. And so he says they're sitting there and having like coffee, cake, and tea, and that, you know, Sagan told him, he says, look, you know, Stan, of course I realize that there's at least something to a minority of these UFO reports, but I can't be the person who goes out there publicly and acknowledges and says, hey, you know, guys, let's really pay more attention to these UFO kind of things. You know, what would happen to my credibility? What would happen to the grants and things that we get, you know, with regard to the actual science stuff we're involved with? So, but what Stan intimated about his personal interactions with Carl Sagan, especially toward the end of his life, and inevitably, therefore, around the time that the Demon Haunted World was on shelves or appearing on shelves, was that, yes, Sagan was absolutely the skeptic that you saw, but that there was a non-public side about those subjects that he would talk about, I guess, with old friends like Stanton Friedman. See, stories like that, but you never hear that on a podcast, do you? That Stanton Friedman went to Sagan's house and sat down and had, like, coffee, cake, and tea and talked about UFOs with the guy before he died. Come on.
Well, some shows. I'll have to bring it up to him when I am on over the holidays this time because I want to hear that story. But I know what you mean about ufology in a sense. Just to circle back to the point about sort of the rote nature of this and how it's like it's not so much even that like you see people giving the same presentations because you do see that, but it's like every sort of place has the same people too. And it's like, God love them. I don't besmirch them for, you know, I don't diss them for doing them, but it's like, there's not as much diversity of voices as you'd think sometimes in the field too. So it's
that's very true.
In topics and things like that. So it's very, it's an odd field. Let's put it that way.
It is very much an odd field. And, you know, I got to say, I mean, I think maybe this is indicative of the fact that I am moving further from UFO research. And I mean, and it's no secret that if anything, especially if you listen to my Grayling Report podcast, some of the subjects that I've taken interest in as of late have been some of the alleged anomalous disappearances and things, the likes of which are discussed in the Missing 411 books. And I'll very quickly and simply kind of explain.
What, do you have a theory on this? My audience knows what the Missing 411 is. So, do you have a theory, or what's your take on that? We don't need to give them the background. I know it. So.
Okay. Yeah. Everybody knows David and his books, and he's a great guy. And I've met David on one occasion, and I really like him. I think he's a nice guy, and I think that he has tried his best to be very unbiased and not promote some sort of a narrative. He's always said keep an open mind. He doesn't like it when people bring up Bigfoot, and I always really respected that kind of thing from David. The problem, though, is that I think that a lot of, despite trying to take very careful measures himself, and therefore I don't hold him in any way accountable for what I'm talking about here, but I think that his books have been so popular, and good on him for that, but the popularity of those books have kind of created this like 411 culture where people they seem to kind of think that all these strange disappearances, that there's some sort of a kind of a continuity between them, like there's one grand unified theory of strange disappearances and that there's some phenomena, UFOs, Bigfoot, or whatever behind it all. And people,
right.
I mean, they've gotten way out there. And David has done his best not to promote that kind of thinking. So I really appreciate that he has taken that approach. Unfortunately, though, no matter how careful you try to be, you can't make up the minds for your readership. And I think that many already have. And they really believe that some of the strangest stuff is really what's going on behind all this. And so in my own interest in those cases, and I'll mention that I have a childhood friend who's a confirmed missing person right here in my hometown right now. I had another one last year, a fellow who turned up dead in his vehicle at the bottom of a cliff. I mean,
jeez.
So within the last year, I've actually had two friends that became missing persons and have personally been involved in investigations. I've never worked in any kind of official capacity with law enforcement or anything like that. So let's just be very clear about that. I've never, if anything, you would call my interest in my own research and any kind of contributions to be strictly amateur. So let's be very clear and let's not blow it into being anything of greater proportion than it actually is. I'm strictly an amateur. Then again, I'll also mention that Sherlock Holmes was a very dedicated and professional amateur detective. Okay. A consulting detective, an amateur at very best. So, you know, that, and he was also fictional, but if the comparison is to be made, I think that there can be some very skilled amateurs is what I'm saying. That's a subject that's interesting. And in equal measure, archaeology. I'm not a trained archaeologist, but I am a very serious archaeologist. I've taken it so seriously that in the state of South Carolina, I've recently obtained a hobby diver's license so that I can go into the waterways in search of various archaeological finds, ranging from artifacts to other things. Yeah. And see,
treasures.
Again, I
treasure.
Think. Yeah, well, you know, again, but treasures that have to be reported to the University of South Carolina.
Which I don't mind,
because usually they'll let you keep them for your personal collection. But I also have some very good friends there at the university, and I don't have to typically I guess, do things the way that the university system would have you do. I actually know people I could take them directly to the university and do it within their protocol, but go directly to the professors that I know and say, we have something that you would want to look at here, and I can arrange a visit. And that's as a result of, again, the associations that I have in the archaeological community. That doesn't make me an archaeologist, but what we call that in archaeology would be an avocationalist. I have a problem with people who don't actually have any kind of field training, have never done investigations or excavations or anything, have never done any actual had any training in school, have not obtained at very least a bachelor's degree, but I mean, ideally you'd want to try and get like a doctorate or something along those lines, you know, have your PhD, but then again, a bachelor's degree is better than nothing. But people who don't actually have any kind of degree and yet go around on television shows and things and call themselves archaeologists, I would call you an avocationalist.
Yeah.
And that's really
like
what
Bill Nye the Science guy, he doesn't have any credentials, really.
Well, I think he has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, and I think that at one time he did hold a secret clearance. So he does have something, but he's not an actual like doctor or anything like that. And frankly, I mean, to have had some science experience and some lab time is more important than not having any at all and then going around calling yourself something that you're not. I'm okay with Bill calling himself a science guy, but you know, if he ever calls himself Dr. Bill, I'm going to call bullshit. So, and I'm not a doctor. I'm not any kind of trained professional. I have a lot of training. I've got a lot of field time in various things. And with archaeology, I aspire to be an avocationalist. And so let's call things what they are.
Yeah, just to be clear, he has a bachelor's in mechanical engineering. So that's kind of a scientist in a sense. But I don't know. Does an engineer count as a scientist?
I would say so. I would say, you know, there is a science to engineering. I would
I
also say, though,
that
you know,
Big Bang Theory a lot. I don't remember, but I think they
right.
do.
Well, the thing about Bill Nye, I mean, he's worth talking about here in this context of all this, too. Have you watched his Netflix show or anything?
No, I know. I heard about some crazy rap that he did, and everyone, like, made fun of him because it was, like, just really crazy and weird. But, no, I haven't seen it. Is it a good series?
No. No, I think it's terrible.
Yeah,
I think it's awful, but
all right. Well, I don't know. I thought you were going to be like, it's fascinating. So,
No. I think I appreciate what Bill Nye tries to do, but I think that he is the worst on delivery. I don't think he convincingly, again, brings people to the, oh, wow, we really need to take climate change seriously argument. I think that Bill Nye is a guy who tries to be funny and just comes across as being awkward. So he tries to use awkward as his medium. And that doesn't seem to work either because he can't convincingly be awkward.
He seems
and so
snarky
I watched
to
one
me,
episode.
But...
He's very snarky. And that's, again, the problem. You're not going to bring people to your side of the argument. You know, here's a guy who says that he thinks that people who disagree with the science as it relates to climate change should be able to be punishable under law for having that opinion. And I'm thinking, well, so you might understand mechanical engineering, but you sure don't understand freedom of speech. Now, granted, do I agree with the climate denial stuff? No, I don't. I do think that the science is in, and I think that guys like Bill Nye do a terrible job conveying that to an unwilling public, at least a faction of the public that is unwilling to accept scientific data. He is not effectively communicating that to people. He's just trying to be hip and cool, and he's got a new Netflix show that they hope is going to appeal to millennials, and I'm sorry, I don't find anything about it appealing, and I am a millennial, so there you go.
Well, it's weird. There's a sort of like scientist. There's a science like is cool. I don't know, meme mindset. It's in the zeitgeist. You know what I mean? It's like science is cool. It's in the zeitgeist. It's very it's part of this new culture. You know, where comic books and everything are popular and science is cool. The paranormal like it's still like the redheaded stepchild of the of the fringe fandoms, but they're having a show, they're making a comedy, a sitcom like version of the X-Files for next season on Fox, so it's funny you're seeing
really?
The paranormal get into that realm too now. Yeah. And there's already one about an alien abduction group that's on TBS. You should watch that show. It's excellent actually. It's really well. It seems well researched. Like it seems
what
like a genuine people of Earth.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. I've actually heard about that. My friend Tiffany Mack actually. Yeah, she mentioned People of Earth, and I had no idea what it was.
Yeah. It's really good. Yeah, and very well researched. Well, we could talk all night, dude, but I should probably wrap it up because I'm getting tired, and I know you're getting tired. Well, I don't know if you're getting tired or not, but I know I'm getting tired, so I'm going to assume you are too.
Well, after a good 2.5 hours, man, you know, I mean, and then a 4-hour monitoring of the Joe Rogan podcast before that, yeah, we can wrap up anytime you're ready.
Yeah,
Now's that time. Let's make it happen, brother.
I thought that when I asked. I remembered that after I asked you. I'm like, oh, shit, this dude just watched 4 hours. Like a 4-hour podcast. He doesn't want to. But, well, I thank you very much, dude, for coming, for doing the extra time and for coming on the show and for everything over the years, man. It's been great. And this isn't our last conversation, obviously. But like I said earlier, it's been awesome to have you as part of this journey that we've been on over the last 10 years plus.
No, certainly. Something tells me, though, Binal, I think we're just scratching the surface. Let's hope so.
Absolutely. Get the plugs in. Where should people get? Just GarelianReport.com, right? That's the hub.
That's right. Yeah, GarelianReport.com is the podcast, but you can find some information about me also at MicahHanks.com. That's myname.com. You know, if you want to learn about my podcasting adventures and in fact, you know, the book that I wrote about that for people who want to become a podcaster, you can check out MaverickPodcasting.org. And then there'll be some other web-based things going on here in the next few months. So I think by the next time you and I catch up and chat, I'll have a whole new slew of interesting things to tell people about. So, but yeah, check me out online and definitely follow me at Micah Hanks on Twitter. That way we can interact and you can follow my space-time ramblings there in the Twitterverse.
There you go. Yeah, I've been getting into Twitter a lot the last few weeks. I actually like it a lot now. It's a real safe haven from the fucking crazy political part of Facebook. Facebook's gotten way too political. At least on Twitter, it's a little still super political, but it's like I'm not bombarded. Anyway, yeah, that's my own old lady rant. Anyways, so thanks again, man, and we'll be talking soon. And have a great summer.
Yeah, you too, most definitely. And all you Banal of America followers out there, you keep supporting this guy. We want to hear from him for another 12 years if we can, okay?
Oh, man, thank you very much. Have a great night, buddy.
See you, pal.
All right, folks, there you go. That was Micah Hanks. Big thanks to him. Like I said, it didn't even dawn on me that he was going to be able to do the extra half hour. Oh, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. It didn't even dawn on me that he... that he had just listened to that 4-hour podcast until I had already sort of roped him into the extra half hour. So it was really awful nice of him to do that. And I salute his endurance because I'm getting pretty tired. So we're going to wrap up the show here. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Thanks to all the folks who tuned in on the live show. Thanks to the folks in the chat room. It was hopping in there tonight. Lots of great conversation, lots of people throwing questions at me, but I didn't really feel like reading questions out of the chat room tonight or taking calls because it was just sort of a chill jam session. And sometimes, you know, you don't want to, like, infuse outside influences into the jam session. It throws things off, I find. So sorry to the folks who threw questions at me, but, you know, that's how the cookie crumbles. Next week on the show, it's Bigfoot Portal 2. With Adam Davies, who probably hates me because I keep Bigfoot Portal, we're going to revisit this story. I got to go back and listen to that episode again and refresh myself, and you all should too. I'm gonna send it out on the tweets and the Facebook this week, maybe this weekend, and people should check that out. We'll all refresh ourselves on the Bigfoot Portal story, and then we'll jump back into it with Adam Davies. A year and a half later, and find out what he's been up to, and it's pretty amazing. As I said, I was out for drinks with him in San Diego about a month ago, and a lot of drinks, a lot of laughs, met his lovely wife, Nadia, had some fantastic Mexican food at a great place, this, like, outdoor, oh, just awesome. And he's been up to some crazy stuff since then. And there was a whole weird synchronicity. Oh, we're going to get into it all next week. It's awesome. It really is awesome. And I'm getting excited right now because I want to tell these stories, but I want Adam to be on. on the show. So that'll be next Tuesday, May 23rd at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, live. We're getting better about putting the links up and stuff. If you can't find us, just get to the website. If you know we're going to be on at 10 o'clock next week, May 23rd, just get to the website an hour before the show, and it will definitely be updated by then. But I'm trying to get better at sort of getting into a schedule of updating the website, because we've got a good little run going here, and we've got guests booked out through the next few weeks. I'd like to at least get to 10 weeks straight maybe before I take a break, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. Next week's the fourth one in a row, and we're chugging along, as I said earlier. So thanks to all the folks who have been joining us on the revival that is Season 10, the end of the beginning. And I guess that's it. You'll be hearing from me next week on the program. No weird background sounds tonight, thank goodness. No creaky sounds that I can tell. But if anyone hears any, let me know. No people doing dishes, so the ghost dish people have thankfully left our presence. And on that ridiculous note, I'll be talking to you next week with Adam Davies, Bigfoot Portal 2. I expect we're going to get our minds blown all over again. So talk to you next week, folks.